This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The government has been keeping track of who is calling whom. They've been collecting and in some cases reading our emails and other private communications. They tell us it is for our own good, for national security and for safety in a world of terrorism. That well may be, but is what they're doing on such a massive scale that no one really knows everything we can or do or are doing, is what they're doing in the name of safety constitutional? And in a digital age where many of us voluntarily share some of our most private information through the use of social media, is privacy a thing of the past? As long as we're not doing anything wrong, does it matter that the government knows about it? That's the topic of a UNC Charlotte Constitution Day observance tomorrow, and one we take up this hour, and I hope you'll continue listening. I mean, the government will, so perhaps you should too. Joining us is Dr. Cindy Combs, a political science and public administration professor who works with local, national, and international agencies focused on prevention and response to terrorist attacks through links with UNC Charlotte's Center for Applied Counterterrorism Studies. Thank you for joining us this morning. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mike.
Sarah Preston is the policy director for the American Civil Liberties Union of North Carolina. Excuse me. As such, she works to educate federal, state, and local policymakers on civil liberty issues. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Clark Walton is a Charlotte lawyer and adjunct instructor who teaches cybercrime at Charlotte School of Law, a former federal prosecutor before going into private practice. He writes extensively on government security and recently co-authored a chapter in the American Bar Association's Cybersecurity Guidebook. Why do they need a cybersecurity guidebook, Clark?
Well, I think you've hit on one of the important points I wanted to talk about this morning there. The way that big data, the way that we communicate with each other through technical means is changing our understanding of the law. And that's not only important for the public, but for attorneys as well. And so the cybersecurity guidebook was written for attorneys to teach them advise them about issues that they may not have even considered in their practice, government attorneys, private attorneys, in-house counsel, those all of those folks under the practice of law.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us this
morning.
Thank
you.
Most of us, I think, knew to some degree that the government was in the midst of a vast surveillance effort in their efforts to prevent terrorist attacks here at home. We certainly knew that they eavesdropped on people in foreign countries. We knew probably that they were watching carefully phone calls and email and other communications between foreign nationals within the United States and outside of the United States. And also wiretapping with warrants and permission of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISA Court. However, Edward Snowden's allegations of the use of much broader powers has really blown this wide open. So let me get three different perspectives. Is he a traitor, or has he done us a favor by opening the door or the window here to give us a view of what's going on behind the scenes? Who wants to take that first? Cindy, I'll go start with you.
I actually have to say I think he's both, simply because he can be a traitor by breaking the law, mm-hmm. unquestionably breaking the law and violating national security, but doing so in something that matters to us enormously. So you can actually be both. You realize he has been nominated by a sociology professor in Sweden for the Nobel Peace Prize.
I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah?
Well, we obviously think he is a whistleblower. We think that the conversation we're having right here, right now, would not be possible without his leaks. That does not necessarily mean that he's entitled to legal protection, however. Under the Whistleblower Protection Act, the intelligence community has long been exempt. And the Whistleblower Act that actually applies to the intelligence community does not provide a way with which you can leak with immunity these kinds of documents.
If we have legal restrictions on what police departments can do in terms of wiretapping phones, why does the intelligence community have a blank card, carte blanche, so to speak?
I'll take that. First, I want to answer your previous question. Okay. I think unequivocally, I believe Mr. Snowden is a traitor. Mm-hmm. Mr. Snowden chose to take positions that would give him access to certain data. I don't know that he took those positions with the intent of doing that job or with the intent of collecting that data. He then fled to Hong Kong, which is a related relationship with China. So I think we have to assume the Chinese have our secrets. He then went to Russia, where Mr. Putin, I believe, has been quoted in the press of saying his arrival was an early Christmas. And so I believe we have to assume that the Russians have a good bit of not only information that's been put out in the press, but information that Mr. Snowden may have that he has not put into the press about how our intelligence community does business.
Okay. So he is a traitor in your view. But why does the surveillance community seemingly have, and I know there are restrictions on them, but they have carte blanche?
Well, I think it's important to distinguish what we're talking about. What we're talking about here is with respect to metadata. There's a 1979 Supreme Court case, Smith versus Maryland.
And for those – stop. I'm sorry.
Sure.
But for those who don't know what metadata is, what is it?
Metadata is when you get your phone bill and you look at the lines of your phone bill, it's got a to number, a from number, the time of the telephone call, how long the telephone call lasted, things that telephone companies collect for fraud purposes and other business record purposes for billing you. That's metadata, and that's what this case addressed.
Okay.
And the Supreme Court said you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in data that you give up to third parties, in that case the telephone company. And that's where the government hangs its hat. And the specific program we're talking about here that Snowden disclosed hangs its hat.
I have not gotten that the to, from, duration, and time on a phone bill, and I can't tell you how long because long distance is free now. So why do companies keep that information? Why do they even record that information?
Well, for those of you who still get a paper bill, I do still get a paper bill.
So do I.
But
I don't get the list of calls because it's free.
Yeah. Well, this is on my cell phone. On my cell phone, I do get
okay.
it. But it's also for fraud detection purposes. If someone has somehow cloned your cell phone or is using your account for some reason, Verizon or whomever has an interest in knowing who you're talking to. It's their system that you're using.
Is there a guarantee to privacy to be found anywhere, either in the Constitution or in law?
Well, certainly. I mean, the Fourth Amendment provides protection. Basically, what it says is that the people have a right to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. And then it requires probable cause to issue a warrant and to conduct a search. And that's supposed to be particularized. So it's supposed to say, list in that warrant, the person, place, or thing to be searched and sort of what law enforcement is looking for. So there, you know, that's been interpreted to offer a sort of a circle of protection for your privacy. And I think most of us would agree that if a government agent came into your house and took your address book, that would be a type of search. And that is essentially what we're
A lot of us are keeping our address books on Outlook.com and on Google and other places. And we know from news reports and from Ed Snowden that the government has gone into Google, into Microsoft, and to Apple and other information data server providers and said, we want that information. And they've given that information to the government.
Part of the problem is in the Constitution, in the terminology, we use the term reasonable cause. If you'll think about it, you realize that in the FISA Act, as well as in the Patriot Act later, all that has to be presented is reasonable. And not even clarifying exactly what you mean by reasonable cause for concern, which makes it open to abuse. It doesn't mean that everyone who uses it is going to abuse it, and most of the time the government in using it has been very careful. But it does leave a door open.
Yes, but how do we know? Because everything is so daggone secret. How do we know anything? Not even the Congress knows what's going on. I'm not sure the president knows everything that's going
because
on.
Because essentially there was no requirement written in that anyone had to be told what was happening. We're realizing now that that's a mistake. FISA had needed the security because if you're doing intelligence, in effect, gathering against foreign intelligence services, you can't afford to take it and publish it.
But but if it is, as you say, and I'll get the lawyer – you're both lawyers. You're both attorneys. If it is, as you say, Sarah, it would be illegal without a warrant to go into your house and say, give me your address book. Why is it legal for them to go into Google and say, give me that person's or all of these people's contact information?
Well, I think the argument that's being made is that that's actually under Section 702 of the FISA now. What they're saying is that you don't have an expectation of privacy or they don't have a right that is recognized by the federal government when they're dealing with foreigners. So what they're doing is using sort of an algorithm to try and identify people who are actually foreign and you know, making some assumptions there because we've heard a lot about how accurate their algorithm really is. And they're kind of conflating this idea of connecting with or communicating with foreigners with the idea of perhaps relating information about foreign intelligence.
Under the Constitution, have foreigners had traditionally had protections that that are common to those of us who are natural born citizens?
Foreigners abroad have not traditionally been protected by constitutional rights.
What about foreigners in this country?
We believe that foreigners with anyone inside the bounds of the United States is protected by the Constitution.
So, but are they treated differently in the FISA courts and in the fight against terrorism?
Well, I think the problem you're seeing with the FISA courts is that they're looking at certain indicators that seem to say that you are foreign. They're not asking for proof. Unless they have actually evidence that you are not foreign, they're allowed to make some assumptions that you are based on certain.
But in the process of getting information on foreigners and foreigners outside the country and those who may be connected in some peripheral way or directly to terrorism, evidently they are going through all of our records, all of our phone conversations, even our emails. What makes that legal or even wise?
If I could speak to that a little bit, and that's what I said, it's important to be clear. There's so many different – criminal investigations domestically where there are certain surveillance laws and protections that apply. There are those abroad that the intelligence community has dealt with for years. And then there's this tension between the two. There's this intersection. What happens when folks are in this country? What happens when foreigners are using Google or Facebook or other things to communicate? And that's where the 702 comes in.
Are they listening to phone calls? I mean, I know that they have these big computer programs with algorithms that listen to key words, but are they actually listening to every cell phone call, to every landline call?
No.
They're not?
No. Realistically, they can't unless you're going to employ thousands of people to listen 24 hours a day.
Computers can filter all that
information. That means you're not listening to them. What you're doing is having the computer flag for certain words, certain terms, certain pieces.
Are they doing that?
Yes. That is happening.
That's an invasion of privacy? That's not an invasion of the Fourth Amendment?
That's where we are at points of
Under the 215 program, which is the telephone program under the Patriot Act, they're not doing they can't do what you call data mining or sweeping surveillance of the databases. What they're doing we spoke about this before we started – each query of that database requires a showing of reasonable suspicion that that query is somehow related to a foreign intelligence purpose or a counterterrorism purpose. So they're getting an individual court order for each query of that database. It's not necessarily the sweeping.
But if they have the technology and we don't know precisely how they're using it because it's a national security issue, they don't want us to know how they're using it, and it could legitimately be a national security issue, is there not a concern that there might be domestic abuse of it? Law enforcement knows that this ability exists and they go, you know, we need this information on Cindy Combs because she reads Al-Qaeda material on her computer because she teaches it. We want to know more about her. Could that not lead to abuse like that?
It is possible. And one of the reasons why the Patriot Act adds a little extra dimension of danger here is that we're letting them request to court without defining the term. We still haven't defined what the criminal act of terrorism is in a consistent way, which means when you're presenting to the in effect FISA judge, this is what we think may be involved, you don't have to clarify it.
When we come back, I want to turn this around a bit and be the devil's advocate on the other side of this equation. Dr. Cindy Combs is here along with Clark Walton and Sarah Preston. Sarah is with the ACLU. Clark Walton is with the Charlotte School of Law. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mr. Rogers Windows, a locally owned family business since 1986, offering renewal by Anderson replacement windows and entry door systems installed by trained craftsmen. Product details at MrRogersWindows.com. And Southeast Anesthesiology Consultants, partnering with healthcare professionals and physicians in Charlotte and the surrounding area for over 30 years, dedicated to assuring safety and administering comfort. SE Anesthesiology. Reuters.com. Barack Obama's presidential campaign raised the bar in terms of their use of data and how that data was analyzed. Andrew Klaster helped create and lead that analytics team using predictive modeling and technology to revolutionize political polling, voter contact, fundraising, and more. And we talked to Andrew Klaster about how these same techniques might be and, in fact, are now being used in business tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the U.S. effort to reach an agreement with Russia on chemical weapons in Syria and the looming budget crisis at home. President Obama's leadership challenges at home and abroad.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning right after Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the relationship of national security, cybersecurity, and personal privacy with Dr. Cindy Combs, a professor of political science and public administration at UNC Charlotte and an expert in this area of terrorism. Sarah Preston is policy director for the ACLU-NC. And Clark Walton is an attorney and adjunct instructor at the Charlotte School of Law and co-author of a chapter for the ABA's Cybersecurity Guidebook. There's going to be an open forum on this topic tomorrow at UNC Charlotte at 9:30 in the morning at McKnight Hall in the Cohn Center, which you are invited to attend. We've been talking about how for several years now the government has been able to collect a lot of information, tons of information about communications, emails, phone calls, and the like. And much of it, as you say, Clark, is metadata, which is who called whom, how long the call lasted, and what day of the week, what time it was that the call occurred. If they're not listening into the content of our phone conversations, should we be at all concerned about this collection of metadata? Who cares?
Well, you know, the ACLU thinks that we definitely should be concerned about it. This, of course, reveals a great deal of information. It reveals whom you're calling on a regular basis. It can reveal what medical providers you're seeing, whether you're calling the suicide hotline, whether you're calling, you know, your alcohol anonymous sponsor or the abortion clinic or, you know, which family members you call and which ones you don't. And all of that.
And why does that matter?
Well, all of that information is probably, you know, these are completely law-abiding people. You're free and allowed to call any of those those lines. But the reality is most of us think that's private information. We don't assume that the government is going to keep and store all of that information indefinitely and periodically sort of query through it. Sometimes with a court order, but of course now we're learning sometimes without the FISC reviewing the query. So we just assume that that's private.
Has it led to any prosecutions, any problems, has anybody lost an insurance policy or a job or anything else like this because of the revelation of that information to some third party?
I don't think that we've seen that yet.
Could it happen?
I think it could, and I think part of what we are concerned about is essentially what we're seeing is this government infrastructure for surveillance of Americans, and we're talking about millions of Americans. So it's the fact that the government has access to the data, and as technology evolves and their ability to search that data evolves, what are we going to see them do with this information?
Would we be as concerned about this had George Orwell not written 1984?
This is nowhere close to what Orwell suggests in 84.
Is it worse?
It really is. No, actually, this is a lot better because in there, the government never made mistakes. All of the pieces, everything was effectively legal. It was not a matter of lots of laws saying no. So what we're looking at here is so much less of a stress. Mm-hmm. It does hit enough of the concern notes to let us worry. The good part of it is that you're right, there have not been effectively prosecutions on that. The other good part from my point in terms of counterterror is that this kind of search has made it possible to track down a number of different incidents that didn't happen because we were able to identify the people.
How do we know that? We're told that, but how do we know that?
The FBI publishes a regular record of explaining they used to simply publish the list of the terrorist events that occurred. Now they do a more complete thing of the ones that were prevented. Mm-hmm. And the explanation of the prevention and the linking online, that's why the algorithms work, is you're able to gather this metadata and able to then develop patterns that you can use to try to track.
Let's talk about Snowden for a second, Edward Snowden. Here's a guy who I don't know how he got the job he got, or how they let people like him into the security apparatus without checking him out more thoroughly.
Well, I think there's some issues around that currently as well.
But here's a guy who had access, evidently, to a lot of information. Why did he feel it was so onerous that he needed to reveal this to the world at large and to American citizens? Why did this bother him so much?
Go ahead.
You know, that's a question I can't really answer. I don't know if he was craving fame. I don't know if he legitimately thought that what he was doing was the correct way to go about it. There are whistleblower statutes. Mm-hmm. There are inspectors general. There are other avenues he could have potentially pursued rather than the course that he did. As to his motivations for doing so, I couldn't answer that. I've represented whistleblowers in the past. I've worked with those whistleblowers in the government side. I don't see Mr. Stone as a whistleblower.
But there are whistleblowers who see fraud and abuse in a system. And then there are whistleblowers who see all kinds of secret ongoing activities that the government is engaged in for good or bad purposes, right, which have national security implications. There's a difference, isn't there?
There is. And he took it upon himself. You've got an intelligence infrastructure in this country where all three branches of government are involved, the FISA court and the judicial, the House and Senate committees and the Congress, and then the executive agencies and the executive. And so for one individual to say, I am smarter than everyone else who is looking at this issue, and all three branches of government is a little puzzling to me.
AT&T, Bell South, Verizon have all been asked to and have turned over information about call metadata to the government. There are other companies that handle different kinds of information, Apple, Facebook, Microsoft, other high-tech, Google, other high-tech companies that keep track of an enormous amount of our information, some of it very private, very personal information, although we seem to just put it out there for everybody to see. Do these companies have any responsibility morally or legally to protect the information that they have about us as customers?
Well, I guess to answer those sort of separately, I think morally we do actually have an expectation that as the public using these services that they are going to try and protect that information. That is why there's always sort of an uproar about Facebook changing their privacy protocols every so often and that kind of thing. People kind of are anticipating that if they set their protocols correctly, that information isn't being shared far and wide. As to the legal side of things, I think the reality is that our laws have not actually kept up with the advances in technology. And so federally, you know, the ACLU has been advocating for years to try and update a lot of the laws that would protect your privacy in this electronic forums. But at the moment, those laws are sort of woefully inadequate.
Mm. And that's a tough thing to do, right? You've got to look prospectively. We deal with this in looking at technology and criminal law a lot. Do you criminalize hacking an iPhone 5, or do you make a more expansive law that may sweep in a lot of things that are unintended to be inside of that law? And then, you know, when the iPhone 6 comes out, the iPhone 5 law is now obsolete. It's a tough thing to keep up with.
None of us, I would think very few of us, read the terms of service that we have to agree to when we do anything online with an internet service provider or an app that you download to your phone. And I suppose that leaves us open to not being able to sue them in case something happens with our information. But could somebody who is pursued by the government because of something they found on one of these services go back to one of these services and say, hey, that was private information. You shouldn't have given it to the government. I'm suing you.
I don't think so. I think once you put something out in the I will call it the public domain, it is in the public domain. If you want to keep something private.
But a lot of things are not anticipated to be in the public domain. We were assured that if on your browser it says https:, mm-hmm, that's a secure encrypted transmission between you and the other end of the transaction, and that once it's in their servers, it stays encrypted. And now we find out that the National Security Administration has been able to break the encryption code. They can read all of it. It doesn't matter. And they can read it while it's being transmitted if they want to. So if we have this feeling that what we're doing is private, but it isn't. So in that case, what are the legal ramifications?
Well, In several years ago, in response to some of these issues under the Patriot Act, the government actually granted retroactive immunity under some of these provisions to some of the providers for a similar situation to what you're discussing. And so I think in that respect, someone could have a private cause of action against one of these companies. What that might look like and where that might go, I can't really speculate.
I think that would be a hard case to make, but I think one of the things you're hitting on, and I think you've mentioned it several times, is the transparency issue that we have here. You know, we talked about it with Snowden. The problem being that we've got a government that's operating more or less in secrecy, and we don't know what the laws really are because they're being applied by a secret court as well. So I think that's one of the biggest problems.
Why do the laws need to be secret?
Well, I think the government's argument about why the laws need to be secret is that, or at least how they're being applied, is that they want to protect sort of how they're going about finding terrorists.
But if ignorance of the law is no defense, how can we possibly defend ourselves if the laws are hidden from us in the first place?
Well, certainly the ACLU would advocate that this system needs to be a lot more transparent. Perhaps the FISC could make confidential orders, but that their interpretations of the law ought to be public. We actually even now have some evidence that folks from the intelligence community have been misleading Congress and the public. So it's active, like, untruth telling.
So let me turn this around yet again. A lot of people engage in social media. They put everything in the known universe, in their known universe, on Facebook. They tweet about everything and follow tweets about everything in the known universe. That's giving away information. Facebook and Google and probably Microsoft, certainly when you visit a website, they know where you've gone, and suddenly these ads start popping up. You looked at a computer yesterday, and now every page has a computer ad on it. Mm-hmm. They're following you with cookies. They know what you're about. They know how you shop. They're monitoring your patterns. You go to the grocery store. You use your loyalty card. They know what you do, and they have to keep a record of it. We're giving away all this information, and it's being used to target us. Could, I suppose, be used against it, but it's certainly being used to target us and our behaviors. Shouldn't we be more concerned about that than we are about the government?
Well, I think probably a lot of civil libertarians are concerned about that. The ACLU has obviously taken positions on the use of private companies, the information that people are putting forward, like Facebook or others. But I think that there is just an evolving concept of what privacy is at this point. However, even in those circumstances, if we acknowledge and understand that we are giving away a lot of information, we don't ever expect that the government's going to use that information against us in a court of law. And I think that's part of the distinction that's made here.
Part of the problem, too, in terms of the public information going out on Facebook and others, all of these are required to tell you their privacy policy. They post it. The fact that we don't take the time to read it is not an excuse. You could demand that the government do the same thing, and that would be reasonable, that you tell what kind of information you're gathering and how you're using. We don't demand that of the government. We do demand it of these private entities, and that's where part of the problem is. You can say you could sue Facebook as long as, in fact, they've actually violated their policy. But if you didn't read it, that's your fault, not theirs.
But we can't demand it of the government because the government won't listen, will they?
It's not a matter of can't. Because they don't listen, the legality of it is, for the most part, under FISA as well as under Patriot Act, there is no real recourse to say, you can't collect a file on me.
However, there have been probably over a dozen bills now filed since the Snowden leaks back in June to try and rectify some of the problems with FISA, with the Patriot Act. So certainly we could demand that our elected officials change the laws and rein in this surveillance.
Is there a sunset on either the Patriot Act itself or on provisions of the Patriot Act? Because that was passed as a knee-jerk reaction to 9/11. Many years ago.
Well, actually, there was the FISA Amendments Act, which was passed in, I think, 2008. And that has created some additional problems. But in fact, yes, these have been revisited periodically over the last, 12 years. And every time, whatever pieces are being sort of revisited by Congress have been reauthorized.
As you said at the very beginning of the program, Clark Walton, you co-authored the Impact of Technology on National Security Law chapter in the ABA's 50th anniversary anthology, and you're a contributing author to the ABA's Cybersecurity Handbook. What has been the impact of technology on the law?
That's a pretty broad question.
Well, yeah. I know the law, we already said the law is way behind. It's playing catch up to technology.
It is. And that's the struggle is, do you draft laws that are specific and address the problem that you've got in front of you today, or do you try to look forward and draft laws that are going to anticipate the technology you're going to have 5, 10, 15, 20 years
from now? Is
that
even possible? Can you anticipate technology?
Well, we've done a pretty good job, I think. If you look back to the case that we've all been sort of offhand citing today, we haven't named it, it's called CATS. It's a 1964 court case, and it's not about the internet. It's not about sophisticated telecommunications. It's about a guy who the FBI suspected of gambling, and they put a wiretap on the outside of a phone booth. And that's where this whole standard of do you have an expectation of privacy that you consider to be private. So you're inside a phone booth. You don't think anyone's listening. And is it one that society is prepared to recognize as reasonable? And that's where the real issue comes in, because what society recognizes as reasonable today varies greatly from generation to generation.
If you have a smartphone, if you use a computer, if you send an email, if you post on Facebook or Twitter, if you make a telephone call on something other than a payphone, or a burner phone, as they call those disposable phones, are you being watched, and should you have any expectation of privacy?
Well, I mean, I think what we see happening is essentially a surveillance infrastructure being constructed. If you take all of the technologies together, we've of course heard, and I know this isn't the subject of this conversation, but we've heard a lot about drones, domestic use of surveillance drones. We've heard about the use of GPS location tracking through your cell phone. We've heard
your car.
Through your car, of course, but every one of us is essentially carrying around a GPS tracker with us everywhere we go if we have a cell phone.
Even if it's off?
Even
if the GPS part of it is turned off?
You can turn the GPS part off, but then they can, of course,
triangulate the cell towers.
And find out approximately where you were. And we've learned about surveillance cameras that the government is putting up, and you add that all up with what the NSA is doing, and we see, the ACLU sees, a surveillance infrastructure being constructed by our government so that our government can, in fact, kind of keep tabs on millions of Americans everywhere they go and everyone that he communicates
with. And I get the impression, I could be wrong, that the two of you, Clark and Sarah, are on different sides of this issue, because Sarah's an attorney for the ACLU and you're an attorney. And you are maybe not on the same – on a different side, but I get the impression that you are. Are you?
I am.
Okay. So this – are you concerned about this infrastructure that the government is building?
I am not as concerned.
Why not?
Well, I think that some of the issues Sarah just mentioned, I think there's a right to privacy, which, as you touched on earlier, privacy doesn't appear in the Constitution. There are certain provisions. You can certainly read it in. But there's also this concept of a right to control your publicity, which is what I really think we're moving into. And there is no constitutional right to control your publicity. I think you could ask Justin Bieber or whatever celebrity that that's the case. This whole concept of privacy came about in 1890. Justice Brandeis, who was later on the Supreme Court, and his law partner Samuel Warren wrote a law review article in the Harvard Law Review called A Right to Privacy. And it went through many of the issues we're talking about today, 120 years later. But if you look at the origins of that article, those two individuals were in the Boston social scene. And they were very upset about names of guests and people appearing. I think this appeared in the New Yorker. Names of guests and other folks appearing in the Boston newspaper, and the whole new concept of Kodak, pictures at the time was very new to them. And they were concerned that their rights in that regard were being violated. And so when they said the right to privacy, I think they really meant the right against, right to control your publicity, which there just isn't one in the Constitution.
We have to take a break. We'll come back with more of this discussion, and I'll bring in some comments from people who have been listening as well. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Jerusalem, showing in IMAX at Discovery Place beginning Saturday. Journey to one of the world's oldest and most enigmatic cities, exploring history and discovering our common heritage. Tickets at discoveryplace.org. And Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia, introducing the all-new redesigned 2014 Forester, providing more legroom and rear cargo space, a CVT transmission, and up to 32 mpg. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. www.diannereem.com. Frank Sesno is in for Diane Rehm today on the Diane Rehm Show to talk about U.S. efforts to reach an agreement with Russia on chemical weapons in Syria and the looming budget crisis, an update on President Barack Obama's leadership challenges at home and abroad in 20 minutes at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, a good place to start is at WFAE.org/CharlotteTalks, and we are coming right back.
To give you more programming and less fundraising, we're encouraging you to pledge your support now to help shorten our fall fundraiser. Every dollar received before the campaign will go toward the $550,000 goal, and for every $55,000 raised, we'll take a day off the fund drive. You'll also be enrolled in a drawing for a trip for two to Hawaii. No pledge is necessary to enter. Pledge your support today at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Dr. Cynthia Combs from UNC Charlotte. She's an anti-terrorism expert and a professor of public policy. Sarah Preston is policy director of the ACLU of North Carolina. And Clark Walton is an attorney and an adjunct instructor at the Charlotte School of Law, co-author of a chapter in the ABA's Cybersecurity Guidebook. There's an open forum on this tomorrow morning at 9:30 at UNC Charlotte in McKnight Hall in the Cohn Center. Jacob on the web writes, how much safer are we because of these programs? In other words, what sort of data is there to suggest that we have been saved from terrorist attacks because of these programs? You mentioned, Cindy, that the government, the FBI, does publish these things. But how do we know they're not making this stuff up? Seriously.
Realistically, we have no way to go back and say actually prove that what the FBI lists as having been able to do. But most of the people they've caught this way have gone, in effect, into the criminal prosecution system, mm-hmm. and a number have been, in effect, convicted of planning terrorist attack because. So you're beginning to build a court record mm-hmm. of this kind of successful intervention using this kind of wiretap.
So we were unquestionably, and you were on this program many, many times in the aftermath of 9/11, we were unquestionably traumatized
yes.
by that event. And in the wake of that event, we were all too happy to get a handle on this problem we call terrorism, and particularly terrorists operating inside the United States, and gave the government great latitude to take care of the problem on our behalf. Should we trust the government?
We should keep in mind what Benjamin Franklin said, and that is to give up, in effect, liberty in order to be more secure, you stand to lose both. So it's not a matter of saying we can't trust the government, but there has to be a balance in trying to be more secure by giving up privacy rights, by giving up security of your home and your internet and your phone. We may be giving up more liberty than we are aware.
Tony on the web writes, since you said you would talk about legal points, I hope you will address criminal acts and violations of the criminal code by the government with cyber surveillance. I was not too surprised to hear last week from another source that besides violating the Constitution and civil law infractions, the government employees were engaged in crimes. In the interests of brevity, I won't give a list. Can you fill us in on that?
I'm
not particularly familiar with what the writer is speaking of. I mean, certainly the ACLU's lawsuit is challenging Section 215 that we've been talking about all along, and we are arguing—
That's the telephone metadata.
That's the telephone mm-hmm. metadata section. You know, one of our arguments is that they actually are violating the Section 215 itself, that they're going beyond what that section permits.
What does it permit?
Well, what it seems to permit is the government is supposed to be able to collect so-called business records. That's what that provision is really about. What the government is getting from telephone companies are sort of they're demanding prospective business records over the course of perhaps as long as 7 years that would encapsulate. You know, we've already talked about the location information and all of that, but. Those are what the government is demanding. What the actual provision allows is for the government to demand relevant documents to foreign intelligence investigations. And it doesn't necessarily envision, if you a plain reading of the statute, doesn't envision them getting prospective records. It envisions them getting records that have been created by the telephone company.
There's also a Section 702 program. What is that, Clark? That was recently, I guess, declassified. The existence of it was recently declassified.
702 is a program that collection of data against non-U.S. citizens who are outside the United States without a warrant for intelligence purposes. And you say, well, why does that? That sounds like, you know, regular intelligence collection. In our age of the internet and data, you've got packets traveling worldwide, and some of those packets are traveling through the United States, even though both endpoints are overseas. You can't target people, cannot target people outside the United States under this program. You would need a separate court order from the FISC, the court, to target those individuals. There are minimization procedures that have to be approved by the court in case you do inadvertently collect U.S. citizens' data.
The Director of National Intelligence, the Office of National Intelligence, is a man named James Clapper. Most of us have never heard of him. He's certainly not elected. Where does he rank in terms of power or importance when you put him alongside the Director of the FBI and the Director of the CIA and the Director of other intelligence organizations in the United States?
And that's a question. The answer has changed since 9/11. That office did not exist before 9/11. Prior to 9/11, the Director of Central Intelligence, the head of the Central Intelligence, the DCI, was the head of the intelligence community. Now Mr. Clapper is the head of the intelligence community.
And correct me if I'm wrong, the CIA is not permitted to spy on citizens within the continental United States. Is that correct?
By
executive order. The FBI is allowed to surveil in the United States. So now that there's an office of the Director of National Intelligence, has that expanded the powers of surveillance in the United States on citizens within the country?
I don't know that it's expanded. I think it's unified the intelligence missions
of
all of those different. They do talk to, certainly speak to each other.
Part of the reasons for that, though, is what we demanded in the Patriot Act in the first place, and that was part of the reason for 9/11 is that we were not sharing information across intelligence services.
Okay.
The demand to create a centralized, somehow, pooling of that intelligence means you're going to break down, in effect, the edges between foreign intelligence surveillance and domestic intelligence surveillance, and the rules for the two are different, which creates a problem for those who are trying to be able to implement it domestically, but satisfied.
Well, and I would just add that as far as 702 goes, it's supposed to target foreign nationals outside the bounds of the United States. But of course, the targeting that they use is not perfect. And in fact, from what we can tell, is far from perfect. It has a pretty substantial kind of error rate, which means that there are probably purely domestic transmissions that are getting swept up. And there are certainly transmissions of Americans contacting people outside of the United States that are, and this is actual content of emails, of phone calls, of your Skype transmissions, your photos, all of that actually getting caught
up. All right,
up.
So if you are making a Skype call to Canada or Mexico or France, can you depend on the fact that that's being looked at? The content of that is being viewed.
I don't know that you should depend on the fact, but I think you might. It's a possibility.
If you don't use Skype, if you don't send emails, if you don't have a smartphone, if you don't use a computer, are you flying under the radar?
I mean, if you're just not communicating with anyone ever, then probably
you use a payphone, or you have a burner phone, or you just send snail mail and you don't use email, or you don't post on Facebook. Are you under the radar?
Well, the government could still use, if they have reasonable suspicion or even not even reasonable suspicion, they could do what's called a mail cover. If you're just sending snail mail, the government can see how many letters you're sending and receiving. It's physical metadata.
And
you know,
they
the
have
addresses.
Been photographing the outside of envelopes for years.
Could
you
do
realize
so.
Under FISA, that was how you did it because you did not have the technology when the FISA Act was put together.
The Office of the Director of National Intelligence has a mission statement which says that they exemplify American values, operate under the rule of law at all times, and respect privacy, civil liberties, and human rights. Do they?
We certainly at the ACLU do not believe that they do. Our feeling is, again, they've misled the public and Congress about what they're doing, and we think that part of the problem here is that we need a lot more transparency so that we can know whether they are actually, we can verify whether or not they're actually abiding by the Constitution and respecting civil liberties.
After the Snowden revelations and the congressional hearings that followed, the president directed Mr. Clapper, who is the director of the Office of National Intelligence, to establish a review group responsible for issuing a report on how surveillance programs impact our security, our privacy, and our foreign policy. Has that report been issued yet?
There's been a white paper, what's called the government's white paper on Section 215 was issued, I believe, about a month ago, detailing how that program operates and trying to promote transparency there, since the sources and methods are already out of the hat, being transparent with the people.
And the purpose of this, according to the president, is to maintain the trust of the people. Why would putting the man in charge of this spying organization to report on his own organization restore our trust?
And I'd focus again on it. He doesn't, no one piece of this puzzle operates in a vacuum. There's multi-layered oversight, not only within the executive agencies, Department of Justice doing the review, all the way up to the president's cabinet doing the review. You've got judicial review by the FISC, which also has an appellate procedure. It's not its own end-all, be-all, as well as the House and Senate intelligence committees. And they've even said the details of this program for years have been opened up to all members of Congress if they wanted to look at it.
You were on this, I said, Cindy, you were on this program, Dr. Combs, many times in the aftermath of 9/11 as we grappled to understand what the heck had happened and why, and who the players were and what their background was. So you really do understand a lot of this. How do you feel about all of the things that the government has done and put in place to protect us from future terrorist attacks like what happened on 9/11?
I worry about it as the ACLU does to some degree, because I think it was done under a great deal of pressure. The Patriot Act was passed too fast without looking carefully at what we were doing, where we were going, responding to a national demand to do something. Mm-hmm. Usually when you make a quick off-the-shoulder response, you're going to make a lot of mistakes with it. I'm what would you say, reassured that we're trying periodically to tighten it back up, but we have a huge number of steps still to go. Internationally, we're regarded as effectively spying our own people in ways that most other democracies would not allow. Take a look at what Australia, New Zealand, and others have said and realize that they don't like the way our Patriot Act or the way that we've dealt with counterterror. On the other hand, there aren't too many who've put together a better pattern of dealing and who have moved to meet technology demands any more than we have.
Do the British do something similar to this? Because they seem to have the second most number of terrorist attacks.
They do. But they also the Patriot Act is sort of a cloned look at what they put together in their temporary and emergency provisions. They repass every year for 20 years running to deal with Northern Ireland. So they're not exactly what you'd call three or four steps ahead of us on this. But literally, when they stopped renewing theirs, then we put it in law, which is not smart on our part. We effectively did what they had just discovered didn't work.
Is there any evidence that the government has been abusing the powers that they have now under the Patriot Act?
Well, I think the most recent information that came out last week, sort of in a settlement over a FOIA lawsuit, Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that the ACLU brought back in 2011, indicates that there were some violations even of the FISC's, the secret court, FISA court's, limitations on how the government was supposed to be using this data. Now, we don't know what that led to. I mean, the government sort of self-reported it to the FISC, and the FISC attempted to sort of rein them back in and required them to do case-by-case reviews and that kind of thing. But I think it does demonstrate that there is some abuse or at least some inability by the NSA to abide by these limitations.
Is there any evidence that people have been damaged because of the government acting in a wrongful manner?
I don't think I know of any. I guess what I would say, I heard somebody, I think it was one of the reporters who originally reported on Snowden, say is that you assume these folks are probably doing this with the best of intentions. Mm-hmm. They really do want to keep people safe. But if you look at, for example, Hoover and what he did, the kind of profiles that he collected on people and files he made on them, and then imagined what he might do with this kind of technology, you can imagine the kind of problem that we're facing and why people are so concerned.
And Richard Nixon comes to mind as well.
And I think the key to what Sarah said is that those issues, to the extent there were issues in the intelligence community, were self-reported. I think there's multi-layered monitoring and oversight that is working. I don't think anybody's ever asserted that these programs are perfect or that the people running them are perfect.
But if most of it is secret, how can we prosecute the wrongdoers if we don't know that things are going on?
Well, the Department of Justice has a role in this as well. I mean, the Department
of Justice. But do they know what's going on? It's all secret.
No.
Well, I think that's kind of the crux of what this whole issue,
right.
Really. I mean, that is sort of our top priority, is to try and encourage more transparency. And also, relating back to something that Clark said earlier, you know, there are some appeals processes within the FISC, but one of the things we'd like to see is to allow third parties to actually challenge these. What FISA currently allows is the person who gets the order to challenge it.
We're very short on time, and there's a caller, Don, who wanted to ask what happens when people access information when they don't have the right to access that information. I'm certain that has happened in the course of this ongoing program or series of programs. What happens to those people? Slap on the hand? Are they fired? Or are they prosecuted? Or
not being in the middle of it, I don't know for certain.
How would we know? We wouldn't know, would we?
We wouldn't know, but the government would know.
The public would not know. It's probable that the agency responsible, and the FBI has been very good about reporting as they have abuses occurred within. One of the problems that we have is that it's dependent on our being able to police ourselves, each agency to police itself. And we will not know, for the most part, when these errors occur, unless you're going to demand that the government effectively publicize every time an individual steps over the line.
We're doing things that other countries don't like, obviously, and wouldn't do to their own citizens, but we're doing it. And do we want to tie the hands of the government in protecting us? Because if we tie their hands, doesn't that give a leg up to the people we're trying to protect ourselves from?
Why would you tie your hands? You want to hold their hand and make sure that you make better steps. Tying your hands, say you're not enabling them to do what you want them to do.
Right.
What you want is better guidance, a better, in effect, as you say, transparency.
But how can you be transparent and keep national secrets at the same time?
Because most of what they're dealing with are not national secrets.
But how they're doing it, and what they have the ability to do, it seems to me, needs to be secret at some point as well.
There are things that could be transparent, though. For example, the opinions of the FISC about how they're interpreting these various provisions could be public. I don't think it would jeopardize national security, and we would at least have a sense of, you know, what the protocols are.
Does the Constitution need to be updated, given what we can do technologically now that the Founding Fathers could never have anticipated?
Well, I'll just briefly quote the Constitution.
Very
there is a tension there. Article 1, Section 5, each house shall keep a journal of its proceedings and from time to time publish the same, excepting such parts as may in their judgment require secrecy. And so it's in there that the secrecy must be there to protect our sources and methods and our people.
Clark Walton, an attorney with the Charlotte School of Law, Sarah Preston with the ACLU, and Dr. Cynthia Combs with UNC Charlotte. Thanks for the hour.